Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, with a goal of donating 30,000 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank this November. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent, Steve Mistler, and Senior Political Correspondent, Mal Leary. Steve, Mal, I'll take it as a given this election didn't play out exactly the way you anticipated. So let me start by asking, what most surprised you, Steve?
I wasn't terribly surprised that Susan Collins won the U.S. Senate race, frankly. But what I was surprised at was the fact that it was as decisive as it was, or at least didn't get to ranked choice voting. And then the other thing that really surprised me was just how poorly Sarah Gideon did in Democratic strongholds. Now, if you think about the race that she was running, her campaign was relentlessly trying to make this a nationalized contest. It's about the president. It's about Susan Collins and the president and, you know, supposedly, you know, doing too much to appease him. And even from a policy perspective, Gideon's campaign was very, very much like Joe Biden's campaign. But yet the whole approach to her campaign was to drive up margins in Democratic strongholds and, you know, kind of take their lumps in the second congressional district, which is probably going to go the Republicans' way no matter what. That just didn't happen. Sure, she ran up the score in Portland, but she couldn't do it in some of these bedroom communities, Saco, Old Orchard Beach, York County. You can run up and down the list where she would beat Collins by 5 or 6 points in those places. But that was way underperforming what Joe Biden did in those places where he was winning by 20 points, 30 points. And if you can't, you know, drive up margins and you're a Democrat in those places, you are going to lose.
What about the Collins campaign?
I thought that Susan Collins was running the best possible campaign that she could. It was almost flawless, frankly, in terms of the messaging that she did, her efforts to focus on localizing the contest, to talk about what she's done. You can quibble with whether or not those things are a function of her seniority or what, you know, whatever, her gifts. But at the end of the day, they were persuasive arguments. I think that's a lesson going forward, and it doesn't matter how much money you have. If you can't localize your race or make it about Maine, then you're going to lose.
What you had with Susan Collins, and to a great extent with Jared Golden, is they localized to Maine the national issues. They took a national issue and brought it home. What does it mean here? You know, the ads that were coming from Sarah Gideon were all kind of cookie cutter approach from the national level. Talking about the national issues. And I just don't think it caught on. I think Maine people want to know, what do you think about Maine and what are you going to do here? And how do you bring home those particular issues to the kitchen table here in Maine? Susan Collins was able to do that. Jared Golden was able to do that so that they pulled votes even when Donald Trump didn't.
It's worth noting, Donald Trump got more votes than Sarah Gideon. Now, think about that. She ran a race trying to tie Collins to Trump and thought that that was going to be, you know, the death blow. And it wasn't. As Mal just pointed out, you've got to talk to Maine people in a way that they feel like is relevant to them. And I don't think the Gideon campaign really did that.
And Maine voters are notorious ticket splitters. You know, they vote for the person. They don't vote for the party for the most part. Absolutely. You have partisans on both sides that are going to vote straight Republican and straight Democrat. But you got a big group of voters in the middle for both parties, as well as the non-enrolled or the independents, who vote for the individual. And I think that's what you saw again in some of these key races where Susan Collins, for example, in Farmington, mm-hmm. You know, won Farmington. She won Lewiston. It was clearly a message of ticket splitting there where people were voting for her, even though they were rejecting the Republican nominees above and below her.
I'm reminded of something else that worked in Susan Collins' favor, namely that she did campaign. Her mentor, Margaret Chase Smith, when she tried for a fifth term in the Senate, infamously said she wasn't going to campaign, figuring that if voters wanted her, they could have her. And of course, in the end, they did not. and she lost to Bill Hathaway in 1972.
Credit where it's due. I mean, Susan Collins is a great campaigner. I mean, she's very good on the stump. I mean, it's just very clear. I mean, it's a very professional operation. This wasn't a problem unique to Maine. Every place in the country, these battleground Senate races, it was a very similar story. I think Collins stood out in a way because her campaign was, I think, more effective than a lot of the other Republican counterparts. But a lot of these Democrats were swimming in cash. They had more cash than they could spend, and it didn't matter.
To Steve's point with Susan Collins, she's one of the best retail campaigners that we've had in our history. When you go out with her, it's amazing the number of people she greets by their first name and then goes on to ask how their kids are doing. I mean, that is just an incredible ability for a politician to have. Sarah Gideon's running for the first time statewide. A lot of places, no one knows who she is, and she doesn't know anybody who's really there at her meetings. Not so with Collins. She knows these people, she talks with them, and she has a personal connection. And I think that was one of the factors that played out.
Do we learn anything from the voting about the issues that are driving the Maine electorate?
Voters were concerned about the president. That's clear. There's a ton of Collins-Biden voters out there right now, right? But at the end of the day, historically, Collins' margin is way below what it used to be. Like, she's always killed her opponents. In this case, she won decisively. But there's no doubt that she has suffered during the Trump presidency for votes that she has taken. There was a price to pay there. But the problem is that the issues that knocked her back were not the ones that a majority of Mainers cared about enough to toss her out. Clearly, Mainers were not worried about the votes that she took. Certainly, there were voters who voted against her for that very reason. What I'm saying is that there just wasn't a critical mass of voters that were ready to get rid of her for that reason. I think at the end of the day, Collins' campaign understood that, and they campaigned very effectively to the issues that they believe matters to Mainers, and that includes getting federal help, small business assistance through the Paycheck Protection Program. I mean, how many times did she talk about that on the stump, in debates, campaign ads, whatever? Those are results that she can point to. That's why they sent her back.
And when you look at the vote cast results that the Associated Press put together, they surveyed nearly 1,900 Mainers starting October 13th who voted early. And they also interviewed people on Election Day and put together this profile of Maine voters. And overwhelmingly, the intertwined issue of COVID and the economy were just overwhelmingly what they were concerned about. And to Steve's point, Collins was focusing very much in terms of not just the debates, but in her advertising about how to handle those issues, how you had to have more help for Maine businesses, for Maine individuals, and that there had to be more money for the actual fighting of the disease itself. Some of that huge amount of money that Sarah Gideon was using was on issues that they were trying to drive from a national level that Mainers just really didn't care a lot about.
I wonder how much of this was at play in this contest, which is by having Trump at the top of the ticket, voters had their opportunity to punish the president for his conduct and whatever else that they were angry about. But they weren't making that link between what the president has done and what the Senate Republicans were doing.
Or they didn't really want to turn control over to the Democrats. They just wanted to get rid of the president. Yeah.
That's exactly right. I think that's a big factor, Erwin. I think there was a lot of people who were concerned about single party control.
Let's kind of look ahead a little bit. Is Collins' behavior in the Senate likely to change, especially if she's going back with a very slim Republican majority and a Democratic president?
If anything, I think her position's probably going to be a bit stronger because her and Lisa Murkowski and Mitt Romney have already telegraphed on some of these big issues that they're willing to cross party lines, particularly additional aid to deal with the COVID pandemic. You know, those three senators were willing to go and spend some money that the rest of the Republican colleagues in the Senate weren't. Well, with this, such a close margin, then they now may have the votes to pass that.
What I often wondered about is, what if Trump wins re-election? How does that affect Susan Collins? Does that mean that she's going to have to do more of what he wants just because he would have ostensibly a mandate, or, you know, he would demand more loyalty from Republicans, which is, you know, a thing that he demonstrated and commanded in his first term. But I think Mal's point is the right one, which is that what you might see is Collins perhaps trying to be what she's claimed to be all along, which is a, you know, a centrist, a moderate, somebody who's willing to work across the aisle. And with a Biden president, she's got more room to do that if she's so inclined. The only tricky thing here is Democrats threw everything they could at her, and that includes a lot of aligned interest groups. And Susan Collins is a human being and is probably not happy about that, even in victory. It's in her interest, her personal interest, and her legacy interest to resume doing the things that she did prior to the Trump presidency, frankly.
I don't think you'll see any love lost between her and Chuck Schumer, but there are plenty of other Democratic senators in key positions that she can work with.
So let me ask you one other question about one of the other races this week. I mean, President Trump did win the electoral vote up in the second district, but in spite of that, Jared Golden won the second congressional district race. How did that happen?
If there's a better prototypical candidate, you know, just his personal story for that district, I don't know who it is. I mean, a combat veteran, a guy who kind of looks the part of the district that he represents in every way, really. He didn't go out of his way to antagonize the president. He didn't join in some of the stuff that was coming from the left, more left flank of his party. You could argue that he was trying to avoid all that because he knows that a lot of people in his district wouldn't be happy with that. And so he, you know, he almost is a smaller example of what Collins is in the sense that he's only representing one congressional district. I think that that's kind of the way he ran his race in a sense, although his race was not nearly as competitive. I mean, he just fits that district.
And Mal, this is interesting because in spite of the fact that we always think of the second district as being slightly conservative and perhaps slightly Republican, that congressional seat, the Democrats have had great success with John Baldacci, Mike Michaud, and now Jared Golden. The Republicans have hardly held that seat at all in the last, 20 years?
That's right. That goes to one of the things we've been talking about all along, and that's the ability of voters, particularly in the second district, to vote the individual as opposed to the party. I mean, this goes back to a conversation I had with Ed Muskie on his porch years and years ago. And he was saying, you know, if they trust you, they may vote against you or for you, but if they trust you, you're going to get their vote in the end for re-election because they think you're trying to do what's right. He's talking about the voters. And I think that that's the sort of position that you've seen Jared Golden adopt, where, you know, he voted for one article of impeachment, voted against another, saying that one made the grade and the other one did not. And I think that resonated with a lot of people in his district who said, yeah, that makes some sense. He's thinking about it. He's not taking the dogmatic party position one way or the other. He's building himself into a position of great strength down the road. And we've already heard from several people that if Angus King does not run for re-election, which is quite probable, then that seat opens up. You're going to see Jared Golden run for it.
Mal, Steve, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. Now, the election is over, but politics is not, so we will be back. You can, of course, find Maine's Political Pulse, the podcast, every Friday, updated at mainepublic.org or wherever you download your podcasts from. Steve also produces the Maine Political Pulse newsletter, which is also available online, or you can have delivered to your email inbox. Again, check our website, mainepublic.org. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you soon.